Welcome to Radio Literature, Madison's weekly look at poetry, fiction, nonfiction, theater, and experimental writing for readers of all ages. Settle in for a half hour of conversation on radio literature. Here's your host, Melvin Hinton.
Well, good evening, everybody. Welcome to another edition of Radio Literature. Tonight, our guest is the director of a film that's participating right now in the Wisconsin Film Festival. He's Michael Nielsen, and he's director and maybe producer as well. I'll ask him in a minute, of String Theory, which will be showing this Sunday, I believe, and I'll verify that with him also at Music Hall on campus. So, Michael Nielsen, welcome to Radio Literature.
Thank you so much for having me, Melvin. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Yeah, I'm so glad you're here because, as I mentioned to you in an email, Richard Davis is one of the first people I met outside my immediate department because I came in as a graduate student. And unfortunately, the person who took me there and introduced me later went to prison, which is an unfortunate thing. I hate to have that connection, but I met Richard Davis and I saw him several times after that. But before we go into String Theory, I was amused by a phrase that I saw in the note I have on you, talking about one of your early films, referred to as Tom Monfils' Pulp Vat Murder Investigation. I thought Pulp Vat Murder, it sounds like Agatha Christie or Perry Mason.
It sure does. And that was our film that debuted last year across the United States on digital, Beyond Human Nature. And we also played at both the Wisconsin Film Festival and Milwaukee Film Festival last year. And that was a project 9 years in the making. You know, it's a true crime documentary about the Tom Monfils murder investigation in Green Bay, Wisconsin, from 1992 to 1995. Folks who were following along at that time will recall it, that six paper mill workers were convicted of conspiracy to murder their coworker by tying a jump rope around his neck attached to a 50-pound weight and throwing him into a pulp vat. This is at a paper mill in Green Bay. And if Green Bay wasn't known for the Packers, it would be known primarily as a paper mill town. So it was kind of an iconic Green Bay story, captivated much of the Midwest and much of the nation, but it happened to be happening, the trial happened in 95, exactly at the same time as the OJ trial. So it got upstaged quite a bit at that time. But it's quite a story, and all of the Monfils six now are no longer in prison. So it was a fascinating story, and it's still unfolding to this day. They're still having panels now talking about the story and all that stuff, and it still divides that town. You talk to people on the street.
Now, you are from Wisconsin. You were born in Milwaukee, and I assume you grew up in Milwaukee as well.
I actually didn't. I was born in Milwaukee, and I was there for like 2 months, and then we relocated to Rockford, Illinois, actually, of all places. My dad got work there. And so we were there for the first 11 years or so of my life until we moved back to Madison. And I lived in Madison all the way from middle of fifth grade at Jefferson Middle School at the time, all the way through high school at Memorial High School. And then I went to film school in Los Angeles and came back and lived in Austin, Texas for a while. And then I moved back to Wisconsin. So I bounced around a little bit, but now I'm in Milwaukee.
So had you aspired to be a filmmaker from your earliest childhood or what? You went to Milwaukee to Los Angeles to study film.
Yeah, to some extent. I usually pinpointed around sixth grade. I was assigned a video project as appropriate for this show, actually. We were doing book reports on And Then There Were None, the novel or the novella, I suppose. So I was allowed, because I asked, to do it as a video project with a peer of mine at the time. All it was a shoddy series of shots in a row where my friend or I would trade the role of who's dying and who's discovering the body. And we just did it 9 times. But it kind of gave me the bug to explore that further.
Yeah. So, between that fifth grade or so and, senior in high school, were there any other I can't think of the word I want, not entrees is a similar word to that. But anyway, I'll take entrees into films or filmmaking or acting or anything like that.
Yeah, I mean, all of it. I've come to realize the older I get that I think what I'm really drawn to is storytelling in all forms. But just the way I best articulate myself probably is in the medium of video and film. I've become fascinated as I've gotten older in the scientific research into the effects of narrative on the mind and the roots of narrative in human history, and how telling stories might be one of the very things that makes us human, that separates us from other species. Like, it's a fascinating subject to me. But growing up in the time that I grew up in the 80s and 90s, you know, cinema was the pop cultural way to experience those stories. That's where our myths were being told. So I absolutely got attached to that medium. But I'm having to realize what I'm really attracted to is, as we move in almost kind of a post-cinema, as much as that pains me to say, kind of post-cinema era, as less, fewer and fewer people go to the theater to see movies now.
Mm-hmm. So by the time you got to your senior year in high school, did you know where you were going to go after that? Or was this a last-minute thing when you went to Los Angeles?
No, I planned it throughout high school, actually, to the extent that I more or less took half days my entire senior year just to get enough credits to graduate, because I knew I was going to film school already. It was already a done deal. And so I worked at Marcus Point Cinema on the west side in the afternoons and went to school in the mornings. And then, yeah, I went off to Los Angeles in 2006, right after graduating high school. So.
Mm. Was your first film about Wisconsin, or have all your films been about Wisconsin so far?
All three of my feature documentaries, yes. So my first one was in 2012, and it was Last Day at Lambeau, which was about Brett Favre's divorce from the Green Bay Packers shortly thereafter. What it was really about was a self-interrogation as me being a Packers fan. Why did I care so much? Why was I so emotionally invested in something I had no actual direct connection to? Mm-hmm. And so I used that story, that macro story, as a way to like explore the nature of fandom. And so that one, we just kind of went off and did. We didn't really have a lot of forethought to it. It was just a passion project. And it did broadcast statewide on Wisconsin Public Television. But since then, it's basically been available for free online on Vimeo. So anyone listening can go watch that with a simple Google search. But that was my first one. And then the second one, the Monfile story from Beyond Human Nature last year, that took us almost a decade to produce. And so that one you can find now on Apple, on Amazon, anywhere you buy or rent digital movies. Mm. And we actually had our ducks in a row that time, so we could get a distributor and all the legal stuff was figured out. Yeah. So we grew a little bit between the two projects.
Mm. Yeah, I the first thing I'm going to do when I have time is to find that Last Day at Lambeau.
Yeah,
I've asked myself that question many times. Why are fans so invested in these teams that they pay so much money to support and make them millionaires? And I mean, why should they build the stadium? Why can't the team build the stadium?
Totally.
And, I mean, I lived abroad for many years, and of course, growing up in Nashville, the Titans didn't exist, the Tennessee Titans. And then I come back, I moved back here, you know, 20, 25 years later, and my mother is just a staunch Titan fan. And she was never interested in sports at all, except for Joe Louis. And
yeah.
So so I that's something I want to understand better myself.
Yeah, well, and I took that investigation in some ways into myself and others who I knew were hardcore fans. But I still consider myself a fan, so I didn't cure myself of the ailment, so to speak. But I think what I realized is that it's the same thing that attracts us to all of these, you know, temporal, art forms. I mean, live sports is one of the best stories that you can engage in right now. I mean, it's real. You don't know the outcome in any way, shape, or form. It's not written by anybody, but there's actual narratives going on, and it's I think that explains a huge part of the attachment people have to it.
Mm. Now, is your identity that of a documentarian, or do you aspire someday to making feature films?
I started as a fiction narrative filmmaker. I just haven't made a feature yet. So I've been working on that. My hope is to do one more narrative short soon. And I have a number of feature scripts that I'm hoping to get produced. But yeah, documentaries just happened to somehow work out faster for me. It wasn't a conscious choice. It's probably similar to authors where like just the access suddenly sat in your lap for a nonfiction story. So it's like, well, hey, I'm fascinated by the subject. Let's see where it goes. And, but I've always wanted to get back into fiction for sure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I read somewhere that where you said you're quoted as saying you are not terribly interested in doing an advocacy piece. And also, I think I read that you are not particularly interested in finding the truth.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know about that one. Maybe the first one, yes. And I think I know now that I'm thinking about it, I think I know what you mean by the second one. So the first one, yes. So to explain what I mean by that, I have kind of two lanes. I have a lane where I am hired as a for hire storyteller through Story First Media, my production company, and we do anything for that. We'll do commercial stuff. We'll do PR stuff. We'll do anything, and as well as political and advocacy work if someone desires. But then my other lane, which is the passion lane, the filmmaking lane, the storyteller that's just trying to touch an audience, human to human, put what's in my heart into another person's heart. That's the realm where I don't really want to veer into advocacy, because to me, that's a different project. That's a different artistic goal. And so because I do that all the time for my commercial work, with nonprofits and for profits, when I do my passion work, I try to touch the whole audience as best I can. And our first two documentaries were very divisive. I mean, you know, it seems funny now, but like back at the time, Last Day at Lambeau divided people because there were people who were viscerally anti-Favre and viscerally for Favre. But everyone seemed to walk out of the theater after the screenings having enjoyed the movie, felt like their side was articulated well, and they just disagreed with whatever the other half was saying. Same thing for Beyond Human Nature, obviously much higher stakes. Now we're talking about homicide cases. We're talking about people in prison for life. We're talking about, you know, families that are invested in all this. And even with that one, one of my proudest aspects of that film is that we had separate screenings where the main characters on both sides of that case attended and held Q&As afterwards. So in Green Bay at the premiere, we had some members of the Monfal Six, the men who were convicted and sent to prison, what they would say incorrectly and unjustly, and they were able to speak about that. Then in Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Film Festival, we had the prosecution and the lead investigator show up for Q&A afterwards and talk about their side of it. And I take a lot of pride in being able to accurately represent people in good faith over a divisive issue, so that the audience's agency to make up their own mind and you know, come to their own conclusions is preserved. I haven't stacked the deck against them. So that's maybe what a longer way of explaining what I mean when I'm not trying to advocate for something, and I'm also not trying to say this is what happened. I'm not banging that drum.
Mm-hmm. Again, your interest is in telling the story.
Yeah, and trying to understand maybe the anatomy of these disagreements, the anatomy of why things get so divisive, I guess. Why you know, it's all probably going back to some form of that same question about fandom. Why do we care so much? You know, it's just trying to understand what motivates people, you know, the moral psychology of things. And just at different levels of stakes. I mean, I'm only comparing them in terms of philosophy. I have obviously understand that sports and you know, murder are completely different things. But the way that the public gets invested, you know, there was so much of the public with the Tom Monfels case that didn't know anyone directly involved either, but they also got extremely invested in the outcome of that case. So, you know, it's trying to understand that. It's trying to understand what motivates people.
Mm-hmm. I love the title, Give the Drummer Some. did you come up with that, or is that, or did you find that somewhere?
No, I got to give all credit to Mr. Trevor Banks on that one, who's the director of that one, living out of Brooklyn, former Madison Memorial High School student as well. That's his baby, that project. He's the director, and I'm a producer on it. Give the Drummer Some Sights, the time when James Brown, in the middle of the recording of Cold Sweat, shouts out Clyde Stubblefield. And so Trevor lifted that and has been using that as the title for his upcoming in-production Clyde Stubblefield documentary. So we're very excited about that one.
Yeah. Now, was that first, or was that, or was The Last Hour your first feature?
Oh man, The Last Hour was my thesis film in high school, or film school rather. Give the Drummer Some started production in 2015. And Trevor got started on that first and then brought me on pretty quickly while Clyde Stubblefield was still alive. So we got to interview him, hear his story, you know, and then most Madisonians who are into music, I'm sure, have heard some version of his story at this point. But, you know, the point of the film is in exploring the legacy that Clyde lived in Madison and in his recording career, and to give him props in ways that he wasn't really afforded much in life, in the sense that, you know, he came about in an era that session musicians weren't credited in the same way, weren't given royalty rights in the same way. So he, you know, the end of his life wasn't as comfortable as it should have been. I mean, you know, many people know the detail that the Prince ended up paying a lot of Clyde's medical bills late in life because Clyde needed it. But the fact that Prince did it is also a demonstration of Clyde's impact, right? So like, you know, how wide it was is really remarkable. So Trevor's been working his butt off on that. He's the exact right person to be telling that story to. He grew up with Clyde almost as an uncle to him, just based on his family. So the proximity and the access and the intimacy that comes from that relationship is really going to make that a very special film.
Are you a musician in any way, in any form?
I was. I played drums in high school, and then I like to say I sold my drum kit for film money, essentially. So I kind of they're both too expensive of art forms for me to have done both at the same time at that age. You know, I'm sure it would have been a lot easier if I wanted to be a novelist or something. Then I would just need pen and paper, but unfortunately.
So before we go into string theory, have you already started planning your next project, your next venture?
Yeah, so I'm working right now at very early development on a short fiction narrative film. It's inspired by a story that was told to me by a criminal defense attorney in Wisconsin, of the moment that she realized criminal defense law was where she needed to be. It was the moment she realized it was her passion, what was going to drive her. And it was a fascinating story. So I think it needs to be a short film. So we're very early on in that. And then my hope is to parlay that immediately into producing one of these feature scripts that I have pretty much ready to go. Hopefully I'll be filming that either in winter or in early spring next year. But need a few more things to fall into place before then. But in the meantime, I've got a lot to keep me busy on the commercial side.
So String Theory, which will be shown on Sunday at
4:45
at Music Hall on the UW campus. Did you meet Richard Davis? Were you able to meet him, talk to him, or interact with him?
Yes, sir. So we started filming that one as a commercial project, as a matter of fact. So this one came about a little bit differently than the first two. The Richard Davis Foundation for Young Bassists, which was Richard's organization he had constructed for furthering upright bass and electric bass education in kids age 3 to 18, they had reached out to us to make some promotional videos for them. And this was in 2018 that they did this. We went in then to film the 2018 conference. They have an annual conference where bassists from all over the world come to help, you know, be clinicians and teach these kids and pass on this generational wisdom that they have from, you know, honestly, some of the most iconic living bassists. I mean, Christian McBride was there, John Clayton was there, Diana Gannett was there, you know, David Murray, like all these huge names in the bass world. And they're working with kids as young as 3 on their form and on their craft. So we filmed that whole weekend and interviewed all those folks, including Richard, because Richard was still alive and still being part of everything then. We only had like an hour or so with Richard, but if you watch the film, everything he says in there is like just this gem. Like he had stored so much wisdom by that point in his life and through all of his experiences that he could just reach for something and it would explain not only music, but it would explain life in some way.
Mm-hmm. So was this, I'm not sure I understood something you said. Was this your idea, or were you asked to consider this, working on something having to do with Richard Davis?
Yeah, so it started as a commercial job, and you're right, I didn't finish that thought. So it started as these promotional videos. We filmed it that weekend thinking that's what we were doing. We were funded through production,
but you were asked to do this as a job. This
was initially, it had a different. Yeah. It took a turn because it was going to be just purely promotional, like 2-minute videos. Then, because we weren't funded through post production, we held off for a little bit. And then, when the pandemic hit, we kind of had some time on our hands because there was a slowdown in production. So we looked at the footage again, and we saw there was way more here than just stuff promoting the foundation, as much as they needed that as well. And we did deliver that for them. We also saw the opportunity for something like String Theory, where it's a wider meditation / music concert film on the nature, the relationship between art and life. And with talking to all these incredible people, it felt sad to just let that languish on our hard drives. So we ended up cutting it into an hour-long piece, and now people can see it at the film festival. Mm.
So it's called String Theory, The Richard Davis Method. That surprised me, that subtitle, The Richard Davis Method. So I'm sure it's not a film about teaching people how to play the string bass. The string bass method, is it?
In some ways it is, but it's not an educational film. It's a film about Richard's approach to education. He gets so much praise for his recording career, rightfully so. But we really only spend a few minutes on that up front before we pivot pretty quickly to his legacy that he built as an educator, as both the bass professor at the University of Wisconsin for all those years, as well as what he's done with the foundation and really changing the landscape of what it means to start playing the bass at such a young age. I mean, when he started the foundation in the 90s and earlier than that, before he started the foundation, if you wanted to start upright bass, it was hard at 3 years old because they didn't manufacture many of them that small. So you had to get a start later in life than a violinist or a pianist who could start at three. You know, Richard's done a lot to help change that landscape now, and now they'll make, you know, the basses in all sizes that even toddlers can play. And it's a really remarkable legacy he's left as an educator, and it doesn't get talked about as much. So that's where the kind of starting off with the hook of this remarkable musician on all these amazing recordings that everyone knows but doesn't know it's him kind of stuff, and then transitioning very quickly into, and did you know he was in Madison? Did you know all the work he was doing with these kids? Did you know the legacy that lives on past his passing last year through all these students and all these other bassists who were so inspired by him?
Mm. So when you first started this as that commercial job, let's say, did you have to do some research, or was this just prepared for you already?
We had to do a little bit, yeah. We most of our research on a job like that comes from talking to the folks who are hiring us and understanding their goals, understanding, you know, the story we're telling. Most people who are in the position that the foundation was in, and I'll name drop those folks, Catherine Harris, the executive director, and Peter Dominguez, the artistic director of the foundation, they know the story they want to tell. So very quickly we get kind of brought up to speed on what, you know, what the story is, who Richard was. I didn't know who Richard was before the project, but we did some research on our own as well to kind of make sure we fully understood what we were getting ourselves into. And very quickly, it became obvious to us how special the access was. Like, we didn't, you know, this was not something that everyone was going to get afforded. And Richard himself didn't, when he was alive, so we understand, he didn't always enjoy his interactions with media folks. So, you know, people would try to get him to talk about his musical career because that's what the big headline is. But he wanted to talk about his education. He wanted to talk about the stuff he was doing with the kids, with the students and all that stuff. And very few people asked him about that. So this was an opportunity for him to kind of tell that story.
Mm. Now, is jazz music something that you listen to normally without being brought?
It is. Yeah, when I was playing drums in high school, I was a member of jazz band with Trevor Banks, ironically, who's the director of the Clyde documentary. And you know, I'm a big fan of Bill Evans. His Village Vanguard Sessions record is one of the ones that I've got most spinning at my house usually. I've gotten into Richard much more since 2018. I've kind of sought out his discography, listening to Out to Lunch by Eric Dolphy. And also, this isn't jazz, but more in the funk realm. I got really geeked out learning that he was the electric bassist on the Coffee soundtrack by Roy Ayers, which I've been listening to since I was in high school. So when I heard that, I was like, oh man, that's amazing. the first record where he was one of the top billed folks, was Heavy Sounds. Him and Elvin Jones, I believe, was the other person. And so it was basically just bass and drums, with some accompaniment, but they were the centerpiece, and it's got one of the coolest record covers of all time. And, the music is amazing. One of the things I've learned just from my exposure since this is how much Richard changed what you'd expect from bass. You know, he talks about this in the film a bit, that he didn't want it to just be an accompaniment. He wants to do the melody. He wants to be doing unexpected things with the instrument. And so much of his recordings, it's a real treat to kind of go down that rabbit hole and hear how different his recordings were.
Yeah. Now, I know that, I don't know if I should say almost as important or just very, very important to Richard Davis, was this subject, this idea of racial reconciliation. Does that come up in the film, or wasn't there enough time?
No, a little bit, but not directly from Richard. It comes from a couple other folks we interviewed. We heard a lot about that outside of that weekend. So that weekend, because we were focusing so much on the story of the foundation, we didn't get as much into his education at the university and some of the courses that we've heard since that he was in charge of in that realm as well. And it sounds like he was just as impactful in that realm as he was in the music realm as the bass professor. But the film, based on what we captured and what we were focusing on that weekend, we did not get into that subject as much as we maybe would if we knew now.
Yeah, yeah. We only have a moment left, but I'm wondering, of course, I hope to go and see the film on Sunday. But I wonder if it bothered him that probably most of the students that he worked with were white, because I know, having taught in colleges and other situations myself, I always had none or maybe one out of 500 black students. And of course, I love teaching students, no matter what color they are, what race they are, what culture they come from. But do you think that might have bothered him at all, that he couldn't reach more minority students?
It'd be a fascinating question to ask Peter Dominguez, I think, in particular, who was a colleague of his and the artistic director for the conference. However, it's a very intriguing question. I know that in the film, you see him interacting with students of all races. So you get a glimpse of what he was like day to day. However, I think that might figure in a little bit into the overall goal of stretching the age at which bass can start. I mean, getting younger and younger and younger, that's where you make a lot of that progress. Is the way I would think about it from his standpoint, potentially. If you can get kids younger, the whole landscape changes. But it'd be a fascinating question. I would love to know about that.
Yes. Well, our time is about up, so I just want to repeat for everybody listening, Sunday at 4:45, and perhaps you should get there early. Don't wait until 4:45 to get your tickets, because I understand this is one of those where they don't sell the tickets in advance. That's what I
understood. It's technically sold out. However, there are rush tickets. So, yes, you're right that you can get them at the door. But the pre-sale is sold out. So the only way now is to show up a few minutes early and try and get tickets at the door.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So, Michael Nielsen, thank you so very much for being with us. And perhaps some of us will. Well, you won't be there on Sunday, but...
I will.
You will be? Oh, you're coming back.
Oh, yeah. And we'll do a post Q&A, and we'll have Richard's bass there, and someone from the foundation will do a performance. It's going to be a whole thing.
That's good. Well, unfortunately, our time is up. So we'll see you again next week on Radio Literature.
You've been listening to Radio Literature, a weekly program on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. We are listener-sponsored community radio. Join us again next Thursday at 7:30 for more features of local, national, and international interest.
the 2024 Madison Roller Derby season is on Saturday, April 6th in the arena at the Alliant Energy Center. This month's matchups are Reservoir Dolls versus Unholy Rollers and Vixens versus Quad Squad. Doors at 5 p.m., skates hit the track at 6 p.m. Tickets can be purchased online at madisonrollerderby.org/tickets or at the door. The final home game of the 2024 Madison Roller Derby season is on Saturday, April 6th in the arena at the Alliant Energy Center in Madison. Supporting community nonprofits since 1975, this is WORT 89.9 FM Madison, listener-sponsored community radio.
In a plane.